The Living is the name of the song you're hearing right now. It's from the album Reverb of the Living Dead. It's from the band Shango. You can find them at shangosurf.bandcamp.com. When you're done listening to this episode of the podcast devoted to the classic and sometimes not-so-classic genre cinema of yesteryear, this is Monster Kid Radio, and I'm your writer, host, producer, Derek M. Cook. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Monster Kid Radio. You'll be able to hear Curse the Living in its entirety at the end of this episode. What's coming up in this episode? Well, Beth is back. I know we've been doing a lot of Beth here on the show. I hope y'all dig it. I know I dig it. Well, I've heard from some of you that you do dig it, so I guess it's really not a question. Anyway, Beth is back, and we're going to talk about two movies this time around. We're going to talk about Dracula's Daughter, the original Universal classic. Yes, I know we've talked about Dracula's Daughter twice here on the show before, and, you know, I'll make sure there's links in the show notes to those two previous episodes over at monsterkidradio.net. But Beth has never seen it, so I was excited to share that movie with her. Also, though, we have a new movie that is coming out this weekend called Abigail. Brand new, 2024. It's a monster movie. It's a vampire movie for modern audiences. Did it speak to this monster kid and his wife? Well, stay tuned. You'll find out. There will be spoilers in our conversation about Abigail. However, we do give you ample warning, and I'm not talking about the warning where the count comes on and gives you a warning, a spoiler warning. There will be an actual warning from Beth and I ourselves about half an hour or so into our conversation about Dracula's Daughter and Abigail. So if you're worried about spoilers, we'll give you a heads up before we start revealing too much about the movie. In addition to this doubleheader conversation with Beth, we've got Kenny's look at Famous Monsters of Filmland, one of my favorite segments, and another one of my favorite segments, the Beta Capsule Review. We are nearing the end of the Return of Ultraman coverage with Mark Madsky. Is the show going to go out with a bang? We're getting pretty darn close. We'll find out. Check it out in the Beta Capsule Review.
Have something you'd like to share with Monster Kid Radio? You can email the podcast at monsterkidradio@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a voicemail at 360-524-2484. Here's some listener feedback now.
This email comes from Dr. Bob Tesla, the horror host. Hey, Derek, my wife and I are excited to see Beth dragging you into the land, quote-unquote, behind the couch. I've been a Whovian since first grade when it used to air weekdays after school here. I got Mel to watch, but she is a completionist, so we started from An Unearthly Child on. 14 years married, and we're only at halfway through Tom Baker. She has broken our order for a few episodes, though. We saw Day of the Doctor in the theaters in 3D, so she excused that, and she's seen Blink and The Silence of the Library two-parter because I love River Song and told her it isn't spoilery. Of course, because of that, she agreed to watch The Husbands of Riversong. Later, Bob. You know, I'm a completionist too, and that's why I'm struggling so much with the fact that there are lost episodes that I just will never get a chance to see. By the way, this is in reference to the last two episodes where Beth and I watched the first two story arcs of Doctor Who, going all the way back to the very, very beginning, the original. And I was really excited about what we did so far. I like the conversations that I had. I like how the episode turned out, and I like how the podcast turned out with Beth talking about Doctor Who. So we're going to keep doing it. We're going to do more Who. Now, my understanding, if I understand the episode order correctly, is that we have a two-episode arc coming up, and then the Missing Marco Polo series, which we'll probably just skip over. I know there's a reconstruction out there, but we'll probably skip over that one and just dive into whatever the next story arc is and continue our trek. Hopefully we will make it further than halfway through Tom Baker. I'm actually eager to get to the guy in the white suit. Which one is that? Is that Davison? I don't know. And I know that Beth really likes modern Who and current Who. She loves David Tennant. I'm eager to see what David Tennant does, because I've seen David Tennant in a handful of other things, like Jessica Jones or the Fright Night remake. Yeah. I've seen him in other things too, and I really like him, so I'd like to see the David Tennant stuff sooner rather than later. But as a completionist, I really want to go through what led up to that before we get to that point. And go from there and see what happens. Thank you for writing in, Bob. I appreciate it. I appreciate you listening to the show and supporting the show. Shout out to what Bob and Mel do. Check them out over at MidnightMonsterMovies.com. What a cool URL that is, right? MidnightMonsterMovies.com. You can also find them on Twitch. Twitch.tv/Dr. Bob Tesla. That's Dr. Dr. Bob Tesla, not spelled out doctor. Anyway, you know what? What the heck? Link in the show notes. Go check them out over at MonsterKidRadio.net. See what they're up to and follow along with some of their older shows. The Monster Kid 101 series is awesome, and I'm not just saying that because, well, there's a mighty familiar voice you might hear on some of that stuff. Anyway, thanks for writing in. I appreciate it. All right. Shango's been playing for a little while. Let's give them a break. Let's move on to the rest of the show with Kenny's look at Famous Monsters of Filmland. And, of course, Mark Matsky's Beta Capsule Review. Let's do that right about now. Now? How about now?
We interrupt this program to bring you the following special announcement. The world's first horror head transplant has failed, and 5 brain donors have died in the experiment. Now you can see it all at your local theater in Beast of Blood. And on the same show, Curse of the Vampires, both brand new in gory color. You'll see a mad fiend transplant human heads in the Cave of Horrors and encounter stunning, screaming, shocking terror as it lives. A monster's head detached from its body, causing savage and inhuman destruction. More fantastic than science, more shocking than fantasy, the creature without a head, controlled by an insane artificial brain, Beast of Blood. Don't miss Beast of Blood and Curse of the Vampires, both rated GP.
Listen. This is the eerie, ghastly, sinister sound of giant vampire bats in flight, summoned from the caves of perpetual night to destroy, to kill, to avenge.
Universal presents a tale of the supernatural, Kiss of the Vampire.
You know what a vampire is?
Yes. I've heard of vampire bats.
No, not bats. Human vampires. Beings who exist on the blood of other humans.
Kiss of the Vampire.
The spine-chilling drama of two young lovers trapped in a twilight world of terror, a world of unspeakable horror.
You've hypnotized her. She's in a trance. Look at me, Marianne. For God's sake, look at me.
Learn the macabre secrets of a living dead.
Gasp at the screen's most terrifying climax. Kiss of the Vampire in color.
Live from the Land of Light in Nebula M78, home of the mighty Ultra Heroes, it's Monster Kid Radio's Beta Capsule Review.
Return of Ultraman, Episode 49. M.A.T. is the name of Space Warriors. Original air date, March 17th, 1972. One night, a meteorite fell in the corner of the Kuragusa Mountains. While investigating the crash site, Kishida and his M.A.T. gyro are flash frozen, with Minami and Captain Ibuki meeting the same icy fate. A disembodied voice declares the real target is Hideki Go, who at the moment is on vacation in Hakone with Rumiko and Jiro. Responding to an emergency, Go comes face to face with an alien from planet Mistler, who saves a child. In a telepathic exchange, the alien expresses his affection for Earth and its inhabitants, and Go reveals his identity as Ultraman. Soon after, the alien's superior arrives and confronts him, indicating that their interstellar war with Ateria requires the addition of human warriors, which he has come to collect. The Mistler captain forces the alien's cooperation by threatening his daughter, who is disguised as a human university student. If he can capture Ultraman for the purpose of becoming a Mistler super soldier, he will be allowed to live on Earth in peace along with his daughter. So he places Rumiko and Jiro in peril, hoping to induce Go's transformation. But things don't go exactly as planned. Episode 49 features a winning combination of classic elements, beautiful location photography, plenty of Go and Jiro interaction, and the striking twist of MAT and Ultraman at odds with one another. Especially effective in his role as Mistler Ace Warrior / Conscientious Objector is Fujio Murakami, who had a wide-ranging acting career going back to 1955. His genre credits include Kamen Rider, Mirror Man, and Gamera vs. Gaios. Murakami brings a seriousness of purpose to his portrayal of the alien defector that helps put the story over, engendering audience sympathy for a weary warrior who simply wants to live in peace. For Monster Kid Radio's Beta Capsule Review, this is Mark Matsky reporting.
Bring a fiend to a night of terror, but wait until the dead of night, and from behind the tombstone, maybe you will see
the man and monster,
and he is usually with
the bloody vampire.
It's time for terror. If you see them, you will see an unspeakable horror that terrorizes the universe. You and your fiend can make it a foursome when you meet
the man and monster and the bloody vampire.
Let no one leave. Move on at your peril. We will not stop until we have discovered the vampires who seek the life of this beautiful girl
and her lover.
Watch out! They may be hovering over you. Or you. Or you! Danger stalks through the night. No one is safe.
Their fury would follow us to the ends of the earth. No, we must destroy them all together.
Scourge of mankind, they shall be found. I hereby summon to this place next week every person within the sound of my voice. You shall be judges of this eerie conspiracy. Here we shall meet Lionel Barrymore, Elizabeth Allen, Bela Lugosi, Jean Herschel, Lionel Atwood,
Mark of the Vampire.
Hello there, Monster Kid Radio heads. This is Kenny with a look at Famous Monsters of Filmland. This week, we are taking another look at the Universal classic Dracula's Daughter. Not too long ago, we heard FM's coverage of the film itself. Today, we will talk about the vampire's nemesis, Otto Kruger, who played Dr. Jeffrey Garth in the film. In 1973, Forey discovered that Mr. Krueger was still alive at 88 and living in Los Angeles. Let's hear what happened from FM 100 and later FM 113. The doctor who defied Dracula's daughter lives. Yes, Dr. Jeffrey Garth is alive and as well as can be expected when one reaches the venerable age of 88. It was approximately 40 years ago that this famed psychiatrist was retained as counsel to defend Dr. Van Helsing against the murder charge that he had killed the infamous father of Countess Myra. For the Countess' father was none other than Count Dracula, and Myra his menacing undead offspring. In other words, as you have no doubt by now surmised, we are speaking about Otto Krueger, the actor who played opposite Gloria Holden in the horror film of 1936, in which she hoped to win freedom from her dread thrall to the powers of darkness in Universal's Dracula's Daughter. Mr. Krueger also delighted audiences as the mad scientist in the Ape Woman melodrama of 1944, Jungle Captive, and played in Tarzan's Desert Mystery with its giant spider, dinosaurs, and man-eating plants. The photo of Mr. Krueger on this page, as you remember him in Jungle Captive, may be the last to be signed by him. In fact, only the signature is his, the inscription having been kindly supplied by his loving wife, as illness has taken almost all the strength from his hands, but he is otherwise well, alert, and interested in life. And his wife assures us he was as pleased as punch to be featured on the cover of our 81st issue, and would be even more pleased to hear from fans among our readers. Once again, as with Lon Chaney Jr. and Henry Hull, FM's editor is happy to extend a personal service and will gladly forward to Otto Krueger any appreciative letters and cards of good cheer. Don't ask for anything or expect a reply. Someday you'll understand how it is if you reach 88. As I write these words, I have just spoken over the telephone with Mrs. Sue Krueger, the widow of the late star, who had just come from the memorial services for him where many of his old Hollywood friends were present. The chances of his dying on 6th of September, 1974, were 365-1, and Mrs. Krueger agreed with me that it was very strange that his life should end on that date, for it was exactly 89 years earlier that it began. Otto Krueger died of the last of a series of strokes, which had begun 12 years earlier at the Motion Picture Country Hospital, where he had been cared for during the last month of his life. Two East Coast FM fans, Art and Tammy Saha, and I visited the ailing Mr. Krueger in his home just 4 months before he passed away, and it is very likely that we were the last fans to photograph and tape him. When Mr. Saha asked if it were all right to take pictures of him, Mr. Krueger cordially replied, "You can do anything you like, young man." When Mrs. Saha confessed to him that she had been in love with him on the screen for years, he arched an eyebrow, gave her that famous penetrating stare, and declared theatrically, "Lies." On that memorable occasion, his wife took me aside in their living room and told me how much it had meant to her husband to be remembered with the many letters from FM readers. She also told me how, 55 years ago, when she was a young woman beginning to make a reputation for herself on the Broadway stage, she searched her soul whether to go on to stardom as an actress or to sacrifice her career to become the wife of Otto Krueger. "I cried for a week," she said, "but I made the right decision. He's been a wonderful husband and has been a wonderful life." It was obvious that while Otto was a star to the public, Sue was his star in private life. September 30th would have been their 55th wedding anniversary.
But I can't resist that passionate kiss I love with Dracula's daughter.
Life has many strange secrets.
And none is stranger than the curse of the blood ghouls. In the dark of night, they leave their tombs to satisfy their need for blood. Because these demons of the undead can exist only by ravishing the living.
Let me go.
Please. paranormal powers of love, they enslave the unwary. On them the horrible telltale fang mark of the vampire. Life-devouring monsters in human form. They can be anywhere, everywhere.
Louise!
No one is safe. By destroying them, will a town gone wild with terror and fear be free of the curse of the blood ghouls?
Today's young people find it fascinating to dabble in the supernatural.
How would you feel about driving a wooden stake through somebody's heart? Because they think you and I are going to have to kill Count Yorga.
It's conceivable that Paul and Erica might have turned into vampires. If that's true, we'll have to kill them too.
Count Yorga Vampire is a horror-haunting tale of today that could happen to you. Count Yorga Vampire is not of the past. It is now. See Count Yorga Vampire, rated GP, parental guidance suggested.
This is Count Vlad. But you may recognize me by my more familiar name, Count Dracula. And I'm here to offer you a friendly warning. Derek and his guests often get excited, and occasionally this results in revealing key plot points of the movies they're discussing. In your parlance, you might call these revelations spoilers. You know how the children of the night, monster kids, can get sometimes. So consider yourself warned, and don't come begging to me to kill them for their transgressions afterward. I have more pressing issues to take care of, like that pesky Van Helsing.
What do you mean with this? All right, folks, what you're about to hear is a loose conversation between myself and my amazing wife, Beth. Yesterday, we watched Dracula's Daughter, first time viewing for her, multiple time viewing for me. We've actually covered Dracula's Daughter twice before on Monster Kid Radio. And then we just got back from another movie, which we'll talk about here shortly. But first, Beth, welcome back to Monster Kid Radio. I feel like you've been on a lot lately, and I love it.
Oh, I love it, too. Hello, everyone. I'm really glad to be here.
So we are switching gears from our Doctor Who discussions and going into Dracula, or Dracula's Daughter specifically.
Yes, a very different kind of magic, if you will.
For sure. Now, Dracula's Daughter, you commented on it picking up right after the end of the original Dracula. Did you know that?
I guess I didn't know that it picked up seconds after the end of the original Dracula. That was pretty cool.
A couple years and time had passed between the production of Dracula and this one. Completely different cast, with the exception of now Van Helsing as opposed to Van Helsing. Not sure why they changed his name, but same actor.
Yeah, that was the one actor I felt like it was most important to keep the same.
Yeah.
Because it really gave that illusion of just coming out of one movie and right into the next.
Exactly. And we pick right up. We've got Helsing, Van Helsing, Van Helsing, whatever. We've got stuff with Scotland Yard, and suddenly we realize that the Dracula franchise began a little bit more closer to modern day for the time, as opposed to some timey-wimey, I can't get Dr. Who out of my head, timey-wimey time in old Europe, because we see telephones, we see cars.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a modern, maybe, early 1900s era?
Yeah, whereas the original Dracula feels a little bit more old world, that sort of thing. And I guess we get a little bit of that when we go to Transylvania at the end of Dracula's Daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, some sort of old world. I don't know if it's any one specific one, but
yeah, they kind of cherry-picked and picked whatever costumes they had and whatever set they had. And
then grouped people by nationality in the scene.
Right. So did you know anything about Dracula's Daughter going into this?
No, I was going in pretty blind.
Okay. And you read anything about it, anything like that?
No, I kind of just wanted to go into it for what it was and see it. I do want to have preconceived notions.
The show has been discussed, the movie has been discussed on this show, like I said, twice before. So I don't want to get into like a beat-by-beat plot synopsis or whatever. But just briefly, we've got a woman who says that she's the daughter of Dracula. She's Dracula's daughter. Whether that is a biological daughter or she was created by Dracula, never really said. What do you think?
I think more created. At the end, we get some hint about that she died 100 years before, and I feel like that was long after Dracula would have turned, so I don't know that he's capable of having biological children.
Okay.
Depends on which vampire lore you're going with, but it would be more likely that he'd found her somewhere. Maybe she really is Bulgarian, turned her, because it's useful to have people in high places. You know, maybe she really was a countess. I don't know.
Sure.
And you know, then so on and so on.
You just said something that I want to circle back to when we start talking about the second movie here. Depending on what vampire lore you go with, we're going to bring that up again when we talk about Abigail.
You know, different movies or universes have different rules. And I think once the rules of that universe are established, you've gone into the movie and with eyes wide open, and you just need to go by those rules for the rest of that movie.
Exactly, and we'll talk about that again.
Now, I do want to say that within a franchise, I believe the rules should stay constant.
I agree. I agree 110%.
No cheats.
No cheats. 5 out of 5 Mickeys more if I could do it.
And I think I got to say every single vampire ever, sunlight kills them. That seems to be the universal.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, universal, no pun intended. But in the original Dracula, he is out walking around.
That's true.
It's just the way that I've always kind of made sense in my head is that if Dracula's walking around during the day, his power is diminished, whereas at night, he's at full strength.
Well, and I got to say, you know, where does he pick in all of Europe to go?
The Pacific Northwest, where it's foggy all the time and you just sparkle and can play baseball in thunderstorms.
I think that's a different franchise.
I think so.
But he goes to England, which is much the same effect as Forks, up on the beautiful peninsula. Vampires aside, definitely go there. But
Gloria Holden plays the titular Dracula's daughter.
God, she's amazing. She's so entrancing.
She is.
Her eyes. Oh,
her eyes. There's a reason why I chose the image of her to put on the t-shirt that I designed to celebrate Dracula's daughter on the show. Link in the show notes over at monsterkidradio.net to pick one up yourself. She is entrancing. I wouldn't need a big jewel to look at on her ring.
Honestly, I thought that too. Like, you could have just kind of made the eyes sparkle a little. I would have gone with it, but
there's something about...
But there is lore in a lot of vampires about them having either a jewel on a staff or a ring or a pendant or something and using it to hypnotize people. Mm-hmm. So I do appreciate if that's something, if you're trying to follow like original Bram Stoker and stuff, you've got that in there. And so I appreciate if the original Dracula was going by those rules, then the sequel should also go by those rules.
Sure. On top of that, in the original Dracula, and we see it again, especially in White Zombie and other Dracula or vampire films starring Lugosi. White Zombie's not vampire, but still. We have the close-up of his eyes. And
yeah.
His eyes, especially when you put the pin lighting in just right, are just like, wow, just so mesmerizing and creepy. And just, ugh, there's something about him. Gloria Holden, as gorgeous and as beautiful and as entrancing as she was, the cinematography wasn't as artistic as the original Dracula, so throwing in the ring maybe kind of helps bridge that gap a little bit.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned his eyes because now, just about a year ago, a little more, when I was at the big scare convention and stuff, one of the guys that I ended up just sitting and talking to over a coffee one day was this totally old dude. He was 90 if he was a day, you know.
Oh, wow.
And he had worked building sets back in all of those old movies and stuff back in the day, and then had transitioned as like a business to having haunted houses, and now his son's dead. Anyway, but he said they would have the actors, some of them, and he was one of them that he heard trained themselves to widen their pupils. Like,
oh, wow.
How you could, like, train blood flow. They would train themselves to, like, get more blood flow to their eyes to widen their pupils so they'd get that stare.
Really?
And that's what he said. And you know, it's an old timer or whatever. But when I've watched movies of it since and you see the eyes, they do seem to have very wide pupils. And so, I don't know.
Okay.
I prefer that to he was using medication to get through some of the scenes.
Well, OC did have his demons. And there are eye drops you can take, you know, dilate the eyes and things like that. But now,
there are eye drops back then with cocaine in them. So, you know, like.
True. Dracula's Daughter comes out a few years after Dracula. And what we expect from film, the way storytelling is told on film, is different now.
Yes.
The original Dracula, almost bereft of music, except for the credits, Swan Lake, which we're going to circle back to. That's about all we get.
Yeah.
With Dracula's Daughter, there's a little bit more music. It's a little bit more lively. And they've kind of figured out their routine now, where we've got the spooky scary, but we've got the comic relief characters, and we've got some banter happening between maybe a man and a woman who may or may not have some sexual or romantic tension between the two of them. Whereas I feel like we didn't really have those quote-unquote rules or tropes set up in 1931 for Dracula.
Well, but 31 was so early, I think, early in the monster movies.
Mm-hmm.
And even going just a few years later, so many more movies sit in between. And so they had the chance to figure out what worked and what didn't.
They grew up fast.
Yeah.
And they really advanced quickly in terms of the storytelling, what is expected, that sort of thing. There are different people in charge, Universal, throughout Universal's existence as well, of course. So at some point, the old way of doing things is completely gone. I don't think that's happened yet with Dracula's Daughter. But as far as the story goes, again, we don't see fangs, which we didn't see with Lugosi's Dracula either. But we know she's a vampire.
Yes.
You know, we are told that the victims have two little pinpricks in their neck, and they're empty of blood, and transfusions are used to prolong their life, the victim's life, but never works, that sort of thing. How did you feel about how that part of the story was handled?
I thought that went all along just fine. I you do get a little more of it given away early on than you do in Dracula.
It's true. True. And I think at this point, they know what, I mean, it's called Dracula's Daughter. Audience members know what they're in for.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe if that wasn't there, people would have been like, hey, wait a minute, I thought it was Dracula's Daughter. I almost feel like it didn't need that. I feel like the vampire stuff is just kind of on top of everything. With this woman who's dealing with whatever you want to call it. It could be a mental health issue. It could be addiction.
Her demons.
Her demons. there has been a lot written about this being one of those films that are in the quote-unquote celluloid closet, where there is the attraction between her and the female model, and her becoming under the spell of a woman who has an unnatural lust for her.
Mm-hmm.
Read into that what you want. So there's a lot of things that can really be projected onto the movie, whether it was all intentional or not. That's not for us to say at this point, because at this point, the movie's ours, and we can put our own projections onto it. What do you think about that?
I think whether it was intentional or not, there were definitely people in the audience back in the day who read it that way.
Sure.
That's what I would say.
And to this very day. I mean, it's still viewed this way, whether you look at it from the point of somebody dealing with addiction versus somebody dealing with their sexuality, for whatever you want to read into it, it's there. And I think that's what makes a piece of art so amazing, is when you can read all these different things into it and take away from it what you need or what you're looking for, whether you know it or not. And Dracula's Daughter really delivers that for me. One of my favorite things about the movie, though, and I want to ask you about this as well, the doctor and his nurse. I love their relationship and their banter. What did you think of those two?
I thought it was really cute. Like, it was a nice bright spot through some kind of dark stuff, honestly.
Yeah.
Some dark psychological and mental health related stuff that, you know, the spunky kid.
This is the zoo.
Yeah.
There is an elephant. They are seeing little pink men. Okay. I thought that was fun. I also really, I don't know if it's because it's the kind of stories that I like to tell or read or create. I love that this dude from Scotland Yard is going along with it. Like, at some point, he crosses the bend from, this is ridiculous, you people are nuts, there's no such thing as vampires, too. What am I doing? We're going after a vampire, okay? And he's on board.
Yeah.
I love that, which is one of the things I loved about Return of the Vampire, which we watched, where we have, you know, the authority figures on board.
Yeah.
You know, I love that. And that's one of the things that I love about Dracula's Daughter as well. I didn't like this the first time I saw it. I thought it was boring the first time I saw it. I know I was a dumb kid.
Okay.
I had it on VHS. I bought it as part of the Universal Classics Monster Collection. And I just was so disappointed.
Really? Okay.
And I think it's because it didn't have, you know, Lugosi in it. I wanted more Lugosi and I wanted that style of story.
Yeah.
I feel like with Universal, you've got Dracula, Frankenstein, the Mummy in 32, the other two in 1931, really kind of creating the world, setting it all up. Phase one, if you will, of the Universal Monster Cinematic Universe. But you really don't see like a phase two happen until the Wolfman in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's a lot of stuff that happens post the Mummy where you really don't know where they're going to go. It's the Wild West in some ways in that they don't have the tropes set in place so firmly. You end up with something like Bride of Frankenstein, which is great, but completely different than the original film.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You end up with Son of Frankenstein, which is great, but is nothing like Bride of Frankenstein. And then you end up with all the one-offs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, The Raven, The Black Cat, all of those movies, which are, again, phenomenal. I can't wait to show you the original Black Cat. That's going to be so cool. But like Murders in the Rue Morgue, completely different. I feel like they're still trying to figure out what's going to work and what's not going to work,
mm-hmm.
what's worth picking back up and that sort of thing. I don't know. It's just something that I've been thinking a lot about since we watched Dracula's Daughter, knowing that we were going to talk about it here. Okay. What's your biggest takeaway from Dracula's Daughter? Or do you have one?
I think it's that we can overcome the demons that we choose to. I think it really is a choice. I think that's the theme throughout it, people making choices. And then, you know, fate is what it is after that. But I almost think the choice she makes at the end is sad.
It is a tragic film.
Yeah.
It would be a complete tragedy if not for the relationship between the doctor and his nurse.
Yeah, definitely.
But those two add a little bit of light to the proceedings. I feel like Van Helsing kind of gets lost in it. You know, he's important at the very beginning. Really didn't need him for much of it anywhere else in the movie. And I think I've said this when we talked about the show or talked about the movie on this show a while back, that I would have loved to have followed those two along. You know, give me some fan fiction or official fiction of the two of them accidentally stumbling into other monster cases.
Yeah, that I would love, actually. Yeah. Like the two of Agatha Christie has appearing the partners in crime. And,
yeah.
And the two of them kind of stumble along into murder mysteries and stuff. Yeah, so I would love to see more of that. That I agree there.
That'd be fun.
I will say the nurse undergoes kind of a transformation partway through in that, like, she decides what she wants and decides to go after it, even if it could cost her. But at the beginning of the film, she's the woo girl.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can tell because she's got, like, the really curly blonde hair and, you know, all wrapped up in her appearance and all these other things. But then she does make that choice and say, I'm going to go after what I want and try to save, you know, what I want. And so I think that's where, you know, the whole theme ends up being the choices we make and the both great things and tragedies that come from that.
Okay. Well, like I said, I didn't want to dive into it too much. I'm just thrilled that I get to share these movies with you. The Universal Monster movies are part of my DNA. I love them. some more than others, but I love these movies so much. I watched them so many times over the years. I will never have that experience of having watched one of them for the first time again, that I get to share them with my wife, who has not seen very many of them, and see them through her eyes for the first time has been a real treat. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
And I know the listeners have appreciated having your point of view and your voice on the show. I think you've made the show better. And honestly, it was your idea to talk about Abigail here on the show.
I'm really excited about this.
Now, I don't get this because a lot of the press, even the Internet Movie Database, which is never wrong, says that this movie, Abigail, is a loose remake of Dracula's Daughter. And I call no bull hooky hickey. I don't know. I'm not going to swear. But I even though they do a lot in Abigail, I don't buy that. I don't see any real connective tissue between this and Dracula's Daughter.
There's a girl, she's a vampire, and I think if you've seen any press for it, you know that.
Yeah.
That's not really a spoiler, so
yeah.
That's kind of
it.
Yeah.
I do appreciate that Swan Lake has played a couple of times on it.
Yes.
So we do have some connective tissue going back to the original Dracula, and it is a Universal picture. And one of the characters is named Lambert, and the director of Dracula's Daughter is Lambert Hillier. So, and I'm sure that's on purpose. I don't think that was an accident. Because
there is in sort of a directorial role. Yeah.
But beyond that, I don't see any real connections between this and Dracula's Daughter.
No.
It is a vampire film.
But that present day,
It is a present day movie. It's a modern day film. When we went to go see it, it was the first showing at the AMC down the street.
Yes.
Shout out to Beth's mom, who gave us for our anniversary a gift card to go see a movie.
Yeah.
That's what we did. So thank you, Sue. I know she's not listening, but I'll remind me to thank your mother later.
Okay.
For letting us see a vampire flick.
Yeah. You can give her a hug. She likes this.
Anyway, so we went to go see Abigail first screening on a Thursday late afternoon. And we asked the guy at the concession stand what he'd heard about it. Well, nothing. Nobody's seen it yet. So we told him we'd tell him what we thought on our way out. Not a lot of like buzz about this in the circles that I hang out in online and that sort of thing, or even in person. There were only two other people in the theater to see it. I hope that isn't a harbinger of low attendance numbers, because I think it's a pretty decent flick.
I think, to be fair, this is an unusually early showing of the one we went to. It not only was on the Thursday when originally it was supposed to open tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So not only is it the night before, which sometimes they do late night ones, but this was like 5 o'clock and we had to be there obviously before that in order to be there by the front of the movie. They did not show a lot of previews.
There were a few previews, but not very many. They were all mostly horror movie previews.
Yeah.
Bunch of horror movie previews and then the biopic about Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, that was okay. At least the music was good. I don't know. Interesting combination. But
I told the guy on the way out, you said something.
So what I said was, it's like Home Alone, but for adults.
I don't know if I understand what that means, but okay. I guess, I don't know. I didn't see like the tricks and traps and all that, you know. I guess they were trapped inside. That's true. I'm glad you said that, actually, because that's something I wanted to talk about. Not only is this a vampire film, but it also reeks of an old dark house film.
Yeah,
in a good way. I love old dark house movies.
That whole, like, everybody's trapped in there together and you don't know who's really who and who could really be part of the bad guys. Is there one bad guy? Is there a bunch of them?
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah, so it's got a lot of...
Except for one kid. One kid just plays the perfect idiot, but...
Yeah. So it's got a lot of old dark house, Fog Island, House on Haunted Hill kind of vibes to it. And I really liked that, as well as the vampire stuff. It is a very modern vampire movie, meaning it is bloody, it is graphic, it is gory. It was worth the R rating.
Oh, yeah.
The directors have said that this is the bloodiest movie they've ever made, and they directed Scream 5 and 6. Which is something else I wanted to make a comment on. Go ahead.
Blood Bomb comes to mind.
While we're watching the movie and the lead actress is walking around, you leaned over and said, she reminds me of the actress from Scream.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, I'm not going to say it because I want to wait until the recording. Well, she was the lead actress in Scream 5 and 6.
So, oh, I didn't get that far in the series. They kind of got a little predictable.
Yeah, so she does put out some Neve Campbell vibes.
Yeah.
Now I didn't realize I wanted to see Neve Campbell in a vampire movie, but no, I really do. And not just because I kind of had a crush on her.
Aww.
Well, hey, in Scream 2, the character that she dates is named Derek. And I'm like, dude, that's right. It's for me. Anyway.
Is it you, Bob?
No. He was played by Commander Ransom, Rebecca Romijn's hubby, Jerry O'Connell.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
He played Derek, who got to date Sydney from Scream. That was for me.
Aw.
Anyway, so yeah, you leaned over and said that. I'm like, yeah, because, well, you know, the two directors, Radio Silence is what they call themselves. It's two dudes. Directed Scream 5 and 6. And
that makes sense.
Eddie was the lead of Scream 5 and 6. She has been dumped from the franchise and I don't want to get into it too much, but for some comments that she made regarding what's going on with Israel and Palestine. So
a recent dumping.
Relatively recent. Okay. And Jenna Ortega, I believe, left, or either because of that as well or scheduling conflicts or both. And Radio Silence is not directing the next Scream movie. I think Kevin Williamson is actually coming to sit in the director's chair for the first time. He's the guy who wrote and created Scream as a screenplay. Anyway.
Interesting.
Yeah, so this is the bloodiest film that they had made. The lead actress, Michelle Barreras,
yes,
I believe is her name, also made a comment about being covered in blood all the time. The directors felt the need to apologize to everybody for how bloody it was. It is very bloody. And I remember thinking during some of the final scenes, that's a lot of blood. That's not CG blood. That is somebody told the two actors to lay down in far corners of the room and somebody turned on a fire hose filled with gore and just sprayed everything. It's not one of these situations where they just sprayed the room and then the actors came in an hour later and got in their place.
No.
They were also covered.
Yeah.
So it's very gory, it's very graphic, and there is a lot of language. It is an R-rated movie now. And sometimes I cringe a little bit when I think about modern-day monster movies. And I found myself thinking about this while we were watching this film. I feel like it's an easier sell to get a fan of modern monster movies to watch a classic monster movie as opposed to finding somebody who just loves classic monster movies and getting them to watch a more modern film, because the classic monster movies don't have the language, the sexuality, the graphicness, the gore.
Well, they're just, the standards board just wouldn't let anything go through at that point in time.
But then I started thinking about it and thought, you know, Dracula, Dracula's Daughter, Frankenstein, especially Bride of Frankenstein, these movies did push the boundaries. Did push the envelope.
They did.
For their time.
Well, you were just talking about with Dracula's daughter, the two women.
Yeah.
And just the gaze they hold for several moments.
There's stuff in Murders in the Rue Morgue with Lugosi's character looking for blood to transfuse into his ape assistant. And they find a woman of the street, a streetwalker who, you know, is turning tricks.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work because her blood is polluted.
Well, wow.
Read into that what you want. So, you know, I'm thinking this movie, Abigail, which is gory and earns its R, it might be pushing some envelopes a little bit because the little girl's only, the actress was 14. She plays a 12-year-old and she's doing stuff in gore and all that.
And not to be cheesy, but she kills it.
She's great. So I'm wondering if maybe it is kind of similar and maybe I need to stop being kind of fuddy-duddy about modern monster movies and all. And I've been kind of slowly transitioning into getting back into zombie movies anyway. So I don't know. It's just part of the journey that I'm on that I wanted to share a little bit.
Okay. So yeah, I'd say before we get into any, you know, real spoilers or anything, I would say in most cases, 18 and above, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Fine. And 14 and above, you know your kid, you know what nightmares you're going to have to deal with and stuff. Below 14,
No, I
wouldn't. There's some dark stuff that's discussed that irrelevant of the bloodiness or whether they like haunted houses or anything else. There are some dark topics discussed that are probably inappropriate for anyone younger than high school age, I'd say.
Right. You said haunted house. So that's something else I feel like we can discuss before we get to spoilers. The set's amazing. I think we already talked about the old dark house vibe. There are some moments where they go kind of behind the walls to find secret passages and all that.
Which is great.
Which is very haunted house stuff, which is definitely, and I can tell, it was scratching your haunt itch.
Oh, yeah. I was bad. They got behind those walls. Which I will say that is the one place where I'm not sure it looked like it really should have.
Yeah.
It looked more like the backside of a haunted house set, which is indeed how Hollywood builds sets typically, too. It's really much the same. It's supported plywood, and then you're putting facings and other things on it because you want to be able to move any one of a wall in a room when you need to in order to put a camera in place, in order to get the right view and stuff and move things in and out as you need to. So it usually all breaks apart, and there's usually a backstage area and sometimes areas between hallways that are long back hallways of their own. They had that feeling, and it was making me go, oh, this would be the best haunted house.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and then I just have to find, like, someone my height or shorter to put in a tutu.
As far as the acting goes, and again, this is a non-spoiler thing, I think everybody did a great job. For the most part, I did have a little trouble there at the beginning with Downton Abbey playing a gangster. Dan Stevens is one of the protagonists, and he's got this very affected New York accent, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, it's like, dude, you wear a tux, and you know? And I know he hasn't been on Downton Abbey in forever, and he got his character killed off so he can go make movies, and he did a James Bond film, and I know all that.
And he was the Beast.
But he's Downton Abbey, man. So you got Scream 5 and 6. You got Downton Abbey. You got Lisa Frankenstein in there, Catherine Newton, who is great. And she's also done another monster movie, too. I forget what it is, though. And she's talking about how she's, like, filling up her monster belt in different interviews because she's just hitting them all.
So that's funny that that's where you know her from, because I know her from sitcom TV.
Well, she was also Ant-Man's daughter in Quantumania.
Yes.
But, yeah.
Yeah. So, and It was neat to see her. She's the woo girl.
She what?
She's the woo girl.
Oh, yeah. Woo girl, yeah.
She's the woo girl.
Yeah.
And, you know, just like in Dracula's daughter. And frankly, even in the original Dracula, Mina's best friend is the woo girl. So.
Yep. Yep.
Or even in the original book. So you got to have a woo girl, and then woo girls go freaky. And this one is not a disappointment.
No, I've liked her in the stuff that I've seen. I want to see her do more. I want to see her embrace the horror more.
Yes, her best scene in the whole movie.
Oh, she's fantastic in that.
It's the most horrific scene.
For her, yeah. For sure. I want to see her. Let's see. She did a Frankenstein movie.
Yep.
She played both the Doctor and Frankenstein's creation in that.
Yeah.
She is in a vampire movie.
Mm-hmm.
Werewolf. Let's see her play a werewolf now. I'll write it for you, Catherine, if you're listening. Just saying. Got to get the big three.
Well, you don't think Invisible Girl?
Ooh, you know?
You need the right plot for it.
Yeah. See, I do have a fan idea for a Monster Squad 2 that involves an Invisible Man.
The Invisible Man's daughter?
But it could be a woman.
Like when she hits puberty.
I mean, there is a movie
called... Invisible? Right now?
There is a movie called The Invisible Girl that's part of the franchise.
Okay.
Technically.
Okay.
It actually has no connection to any of the other Invisible Man movies, but it's packaged as part of it. And it's a fun little movie. It's a romp. It's not a horror movie at all. It's kind of a goofy woman empowerment on her own, kind of making it kind of thing that turns invisible. And it's fun. It's so much fun. I love The Invisible Girl.
Okay, well, I'll add it to the list.
Yeah, I talked about it with Tracy, actually, from Disney Indiana here on the show years ago.
Love you, Tracy.
And let's see, we had Angus Cloud in there as the druggie, who unfortunately passed away before this movie was released. He shot all of his stuff before the Screen Actors Guild strike, so all of his footage was in the can
But then the SAG strike happened and they stopped production on this for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the time between him finishing and the release of this, he did pass from a drug overdose, unfortunately.
It's very sad.
But Giancarlo Esposito, he's awesome. He's awesome in everything. He is borderline that guy, though, that can't play anything but Giancarlo Esposito.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely a role type that has, like, you couldn't just put him in a long wig and make it work. It'd look fake.
And then the girl, Alicia Weir, who did like 95% of her own stunts.
Yeah, that, and like I said, the dancing was, I mean, for that young of a dancer, and I studied dance up until about her age, and then I had injured my knee, but that was really highly technical dancing, and if she was doing most of those leaps and turns and the length of point work, that's impressive.
Agreed.
For her age.
So at this point, I want to talk about some spoilers. We know this is a brand new movie, and I know that the Count gave you a spoiler warning at the very beginning of all this. We're giving you a second spoiler warning right now. I'm not going to call the Count back in for it. We're just going to tell you now, if you don't want to be spoiled, skip ahead to whatever the show notes tell you is the next part of the show, because we're going to spoil the heck out of Abigail in 3, 2, 1.
Holy ballerina vampires, Batman. What did we just watch?
Oh, man. Ah, okay. I wanted to talk about vampire lore stuff.
Yes.
I cringed twice. Not because Twilight was mentioned, not for any of that. You know, for some people, that's what vampires are. And I'm now at peace about that. I was not at peace about it for a long time, but I'm over it now. Enjoy whatever movies you want to enjoy. I'm not going to gatekeep your vampire enthusiasm, whatever. Where I cringe, though, we knew that she was a vampire from the trailers, from the get-go. There's no mystery here. So we knew she was a vampire, yet they're able to put her out with some drugs. And to make sure she's still alive, they check her pulse.
This is the thing I had a problem with.
Why? What? No. And it happened a second time in the movie as well. And it's referenced a third time that, oh, well, we knew she was really out. She wasn't faking it because I checked her pulse and her breathing was steady. She was really knocked out.
I don't think vampires breathe.
Vampires don't breathe. Vampires don't have a pulse, at least in every other piece of vampire media that I have ever consumed.
So that leaves the option that she was faking it.
Right.
To get what she wanted both times.
And I can accept that. I wish there was a throwaway line, just something. Oh, you think the drugs worked? You know, just something.
I do wish that had been a reference.
Because the whole time, after they check her pulse, only one person who was a former army medic checks her pulse. After that, I start thinking in my brain, oh, she's a vampire too, and they're in it together.
Oh, so it kind of made you go off in other directions.
In a direction that the movie didn't intend. So.
Okay.
I know that really bothered me, but it's one of those things, like you said, they're consistent about it, at least.
No, but what about the idea that she was pretending to be out and that vampires can obviously fake breathing, and could they then fake a pulse?
Sure. I mean, I have to accept that if I either have to accept that they have a pulse or that they fake it. One or the other to accept this movie. And I accept this movie. It's a good movie. I accept it. It's just, it was hard to...
I wish that had been wrapped up in the end.
Yeah, agreed, agreed. Like I said, they reveal way too much in the trailer. Maybe they needed to say, hey, and this movie's about vampires, to give us a vampire movie called Abigail that it could have been anything. It really could have been anything. But, you know, I don't know. What about some of the ways the vampires were destroyed for you?
I was actually more interested in the ways that didn't work.
Garlic doesn't work.
Not at all.
Neither do onions.
And... Ooh, girl. And crosses, not apparently...
Crosses don't work.
Issue, yeah.
Crosses don't work. Garlic don't work. Don't work. Doesn't work.
I mean, silver platters kind of work, but in a special way.
Right. So the two big things that, well, I guess a third maybe, sunlight.
Sunlight works.
That's one that's hard to get around, I feel
like. Yeah, that's why I say, like, any vampire, sunlight has to affect them somehow. Yeah.
Even though it lets Lugosi walk around in Dracula, sunlight still works. And wooden stakes still work.
Yes.
I love the idea of pool sticks being turned into stakes.
That's great.
I love that. I loved it in From Dusk Till Dawn. I loved it in something that I wrote in my community college days. I just love pool cues being used as vampire stakes. They're just the perfect size. Perfect. I loved that. When the sunlight hits the vampire, what happens to them?
See, I thought they turned to ash.
What happens in this movie?
Blood bomb.
They explode
like a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
They explode a lot.
Everywhere.
They explode all over the place.
Yeah.
What happens when they get staked?
They explode. We found a technique we like, and we're going to use it for the maximum effect. Remember when we said hoses of blood?
Yeah, literally. I mean, these are, some of it's CG, I'm sure, the exploding part. But the aftermath,
there was one scene, and this one was different. They're on a certain tiled floor in the big rotunda or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And something explodes. And you see one of our gals sit up, and it's dry behind her.
Yep.
So something really exploded across them because where she was blocking didn't get hit.
That's what I mean when I said earlier that it was obvious that they had them lay down in the set for half an hour while they gored everything as opposed to goring it all up.
A lot of good practical effects.
Yeah, I think the practical effects were solid. I don't know if seeing Abigail's hand starting to reform and heal was practical or not. It looked like it could have been when we see the bone starting to grow back out of the stump. She gets her hand blasted off by the sun. And I thought that was a cool...
Yeah, I like that. That was a cool way to use a combination of practical and CGI.
One of my favorite vampire moments in this, though. You see this... I've seen this in a lot of vampire movies where a vampire gets shot.
Yes.
Bullet hole hits them. They start to bleed out of it. But they're a vampire, so the bullet hole heals and there's no more blood. Like, the blood that already came out disappears for whatever reason.
I always thought that was weird.
I always thought that was weird, too, and I almost always see that. But in this one, Abigail takes a bullet to the head. She gets a bullet hole in her forehead, and she's bleeding out of it. Then she sits up, and the hole starts to close, and then she wipes her hand across it, and you see the blood, and I'm actually doing it for Beth's length, but she didn't just see the movie with me. But she wipes her forehead as she's wiping away the blood and leaves some blood behind. And it's great. It was a great image.
Okay, well, if you like that, I have to give Twilight credit. When they get hurt, their vampires do bleed. So, 1 point for Twilight. That's the only one.
I like it when they bleed.
Wait, are we back in Kuwait? No, Scream. I like it when they scream. You're channeling Jarrah. Hey, guys in Kuwait, if you're listening.
I did like that. I did like that sun did work and very aggressively. Now, there was that. Almost nobody survives.
And there's like three twists.
There are a couple of twists.
In fact, the first twist came so early. It was like, I'd say even a little before the halfway point that I was like, wait. How long is this movie? Because...
Which twist are you referring to?
Woo Girl.
Okay. We did give a spoiler warning.
Yeah.
Catherine Newton gets to play a vampire.
Or a vampire's thrall?
Hey, she had teeth.
That's true. But she was under the control.
She had teeth and she bit the French-Canadian muscle.
Oh.
Who I adored.
It was precious.
It was great.
Give a Quebecois.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Catherine Newton does go vampire. And like you said, vampire thrall. So Abigail is actually controlling her from another floor, another room. And they're doing this mirroring choreography.
That's brilliant because you have it in a very tight ballet style, even though you have this bloody vampire girl, and then you have this just out of control.
It was great.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
It was really cool. I do appreciate that. Downton Abbey also goes vampire.
Yeah.
And of course, he is a jerk about it.
All you had to do was look at his glasses walking in.
And I hate to say it, and I don't... Anybody who wears glasses like this is not directed at you, but it is the quote-unquote stereotypical serial killer pair of glasses.
Yes.
It's a pair of glasses that you always see on the serial killer character in B-movies. It's just for whatever reason, it's the glasses they wear, don't know why, and it's the glasses that Dan Stevens wears in this film. So yeah, you knew he was going to turn. And in the end, the movie has this weird kind of absentee parent message about...
All you really got to do to be a good parent is show up.
Just show up.
Just show up.
One character is a former drug user. Another character, well, is a vampire. who also apparently was on Downton Abbey. I stopped watching Downton Abbey before he turned up. I stopped watching Downton Abbey before Dan Stevens left the show. So
the Lady Mary has a very peculiar taste in men, as usual.
So yeah.
I really liked it. I think you should go see it. It's a great romp. It's different from a lot of other vampire movies that I've seen in a lot of good ways, and it combines some of my favorite other horror tropes, and then it laughs at some of my favorite mystery or horror tropes. The movie keeps dipping into, is this a mystery? And then it keeps pulling you back and going, no, the mystery tropes don't work. We're in a horror movie. And so I think that tug and pull of that mystery horror is really fun here.
I knew that's who it was. I knew I recognized the music. It was Brian Tyler who did the music.
When the, obviously, the link to Swan Lake being all the way back to Dracula.
Yeah. This is a soundtrack score that I am going to want to write to, I think, at some point. There are some good, scary motifs and moments, some good mystery moments. Some blood and thunder type moments, or ketchup and thunder, which is what John Williams referred to his own Dracula score from the 70s as ketchup and thunder music. But I did like the music quite a bit. I thought the direction was really good. And I think these directors, Radio Silence, I want to see what they do moving forward. I want to see them do more horror.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need some strong horror voices that are okay working in the horror genre. Give them as much money as they want, but let them, if they want to, let them stay in the horror genre. I want to see Catherine Newton do more horror movies. You know, I feel like in the 80s...
I want to see the big Quiver Clay guy back.
Yeah, I feel like in the 80s we had a lot of, you know, people getting started in horror as a stepping stone
To other things,
with the exception of some of the so-called scream queens, like Linnea Quigley or Michelle Bauer, any of those. Whereas you have something like Jamie Lee Curtis, who's doing all these horror movies or low-budget movies as a stepping stone. I want to see the people that just love it stay in it and give us more. That's just me, because I love the genre so much. I want to see more monster movies made by dedicated monster fans. And when somebody like Radio Silence proves that they can pull it off, not just make a slasher movie with scream movies, but actually pull off a vampire monster movie that I really enjoyed, hey, let's do another one. Put Catherine Newton in a werewolf film. I'll write it, like I said.
Well, the best way for us to get that is for more fans to go to movies like this, because the reality is this kind of movie, which separates characters continually so that things can happen to them or they can hear sounds off down the hall or whatever, it really limits the screen time for actors. And so if they're getting paid an hourly wage rather than a contracted amount like big stars get, that can really cut the amount that they earn per movie. And they don't necessarily get the residuals that actors in some of the other fields do. It's something, you know, I've talked about with some of the other colleagues in the scare industry, in the scare entertainment industry that we have the same kind of issue for our actors, that it's tough for people to stay, good people to stay in it, because the money is not the same as some other acting fields.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You know, if you can pick up like and get to be somebody in the MCU and then maybe get to do your own projects eventually, that's great. But right now it's really hard to just make a living in that one genre, I think.
Yeah. So I want to see more of it if you can pull it off.
Yeah.
I want to see what Radio Silence does next.
Absolutely.
I don't know what they're doing. I don't know what Michelle Barreras' plans are now that she's had the issues she's had in Hollywood. Again, not going to talk about it regarding the politics of what's going on. I don't know where she's headed, but I feel like as a piece of art, I appreciated what she did in this film.
Yeah, yeah.
I liked all the performances.
It was a really strong ensemble cast, honestly. There were a few people that I wish had lived a little longer. I would have liked to see a little more of them, honestly. And it was a small cast. I'd say total, even with kind of on-screen main extras that are like the guy holding the door at the dance studio or whatever, you know, performing center, maybe a dozen people in the whole movie.
If that,
maybe less than 10. And so that's really neat when directors get to work with that small cast and you're not having to deal with extras and schedules and demands like that, getting to really focus in with each individual person. And I think that's how you get these fantastic performances. That's how I would do it if I were going to pull those out of people as a performer. So I really appreciate what they did as directors here and working with the actors and pulling the best out of each of them.
Agreed. I enjoyed the movie quite a bit. I think it's pretty obvious. And
I'm kind of hoping it's a franchise, honestly, and that we get after the... There is a last minute, at the very end of the movie, last minute reveal of something, and I hope we get more.
A last minute reveal, and I mean, we already gave the spoiler warning. It could very well just be Dracula. It really could be.
It could be, but I kind of felt like maybe it wasn't.
You know what? I'm okay if it was. I'd be down for that. I mean, right down to like the Hammer films, like set design of some of the big ballrooms. I felt like Bernard Robinson had designed the floor tile pattern. You know, it was so good.
I don't know. I don't know if him being Dracula is a good idea. See what I did there?
Wow. I'd like to give everybody an update on the Mail Order Zombie Journal. It's coming along, and actually I have received my first submission, and it is awesome. I'd like to go ahead and announce now that issue number one of the Mail Order Zombie Journal will feature an interview conducted by Brian Clark. Brian has written interviews for other magazines. He's an author. He appears on multiple podcasts as guests. He's been on this show quite a bit. He also just recently is featured as one of the people providing a commentary track for the Screen Factory release of the movie Orphan. How cool is that? Anyway, Brian conducted an interview with a couple of filmmakers, the filmmakers behind the 2009 zombie movie Collapse, Insane Mike Saunders and Jason Bollinger of Prescribed Films. It's a great interview, and I cannot wait to publish this in Mail Order Zombie Journal number one. So stay tuned for more information about the journal as it becomes available. If you are interested in becoming a contributor to the journal, please shoot me an email at monsterkidradio@gmail.com. I have had some people reach out to me about publishing fiction in the Mail Order Zombie Journal. Now, originally, I hadn't planned to do that. But I'm considering it. Why don't you guys and gals shoot me an email, again, monsterkidradio@gmail.com, and let me know if you want to see fiction appear in the Mail Order Zombie Journal. I'm curious. I'm genuinely curious. I'd like to know. I'm not talking about my own fiction. I'm talking about something that was pitched to me. So, again, let me know what you think. I'm excited to see what happens with the Mail Order Zombie brand moving forward. And I'm going to keep talking about it here on Monster Kid Radio as we go along, kind of give you a behind-the-scenes, behind-the-bloody-curtain kind of look at what we're doing to get this print edition of Mail Order Zombie out to everybody. Stay tuned, like I said, for more. As soon as we know more, you'll know more.
George Romero brings back the dead.
They are here now, and they cannot be stopped. Close your eyes if you want to. Run if you must. But remember, this time there is no escaping. Dawn of the Dead.
We've got to survive. Somebody's got to survive.
Dawn of the Dead contains scenes of violence that may be considered shocking. No one under 17 will be admitted. From United Film Distributing Company.
Okay, I played that Dawn of the Dead trailer for two reasons. One, I was just talking about zombie movies, and I thought, you know, Dawn of the Dead would be great. But two, next week's episode is going to be an episode about Dawn of the Dead. Now, I talked about it a lot here on the show and on Facebook. The Hollywood Theater here in the Portland, Oregon area showed a 45th anniversary restoration of the original Dawn of the Dead. And I had to go. I had to. I'm starting to feel like Dawn of the Dead is one of those movies that if it's playing anywhere within like an hour's drive of where I'm at any given moment, I gotta go see it. Kind of like Creature from the Black Lagoon. Creature is still my favorite film of all time, don't get me wrong. But Dawn of the Dead on the big screen is something special, and it was a real treat to see it in one of my favorite movie theaters with some of my favorite people. Chris McMillan, Matt Rashley, my wife Beth, and I will all be appearing on next week's episode of Monster Kid Radio talking about our experience seeing Dawn of the Dead at the Hollywood Theater. And I'm thinking about doing something a little bit different next week with the episode. Just stay tuned to monsterkidradio.net and you'll get the episode when it comes out. But I am thinking about tweaking the format of the movie commentary review whatever section of the show. So stay tuned for that. Course, if it doesn't work out, you'll just get a regular. You know what? Just stay tuned. Next week, Dawn of the Dead. I mentioned the website a couple of times in this episode, monsterkidradio.net. That's where you're going to want to go to find everything you need to know about Monster Kid Radio. Links to our Facebook page, our Facebook group, our Twitter, our Discord, our Reddit, and our Patreon. If you become a patron of Monster Kid Radio at any level, you will gain access to the Patreon exclusive movie review that we're going to be doing of the movie Monster Mash. The new movie Monster Mash came out this year, starring Michael Madsen as Dr. Frankenstein. And when I say we, I mean my Beth and I. My Beth and I? My wife and I, Beth. I guess she's my Beth, as much as I'm her Derek. But anyway, my wife, Beth, and I, Team Death, are going to be reviewing Monster Mash as a video review. So if you want to have access to that, the only way you're going to be able to access it is if you become a patron over at patreon.com/monsterkidradio at any level. So consider doing that if you'd like to support the show and get access to that video review, which you'll be seeing before the end of the month. Also, twitch.tv/monsterkidradio. A couple of you were lucky enough to join us when I decided to bring that back and just show a bunch of movies. Didn't really make a big deal out of it, didn't announce it, just started running Lon Chaney movies. Because, well, April 1st was Lon Chaney Sr.'s birthday, and I wanted to show some Lon Chaney films. If you are a Twitch user, please consider following us over there. Heck, subscribe to us if you feel like throwing a few Twitch bucks our way. That really helps us out as well. Because later this month, we're going to do it again. Not exactly sure when, because I'm still trying to work out this whole finding work thing. And work searching sometimes takes even more time than work working. My schedule's weird, but I do want to run another Twitch stream of like drive-in movies later this month. So please consider following us over at twitch.tv/monsterkidradio, and you'll be notified when we go live. I'll also make note of it on Facebook and Twitter to let y'all know when that happens as well. So if you're a Twitch user and you want to hang out with us, watch some movies, and chat it up with fellow movie watchers, it's the only time I'm going to encourage you to actually talk during the films at the Monster Kid Movie Club, that's what we call the Twitch channel, sometime this month. So stay tuned for that. After we talk about Dawn of the Dead next week, I think we're going to be doing a Jack Arnold episode where I will be discussing my top three Jack Arnold films that are not Creature from the Black Lagoon or Revenge of the Creature. You know, if I take those out of the equation, there are still some great Jack Arnold films, and I'm not going to be doing it by myself. Vincent from the Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast will be joining me. He also likes Jack Arnold films, so he and I will talk about our top three Jack Arnold movies. Now, I didn't put the No Creature from the Black Lagoon limitation on him. So, yeah, there's a good chance we're going to get some Gilman representation when we do that episode in a couple of weeks. But we'll see. We'll see. After that, I think we're going to do some luchador movies. You know, we're going to be into the month of May and can't let a month of May go by without some Lucha de Mayo celebrations happening. So we'll get some luchador movies. Robert Kelly from Record All Monsters is going to join me to talk about a very early Santo film. And I'm trying to set up a time with Matt Rashley to introduce him to the luchador movie subgenre. He's never really watched any of them. So I'm excited to show him one and get his take on some of the fun misadventures of those marvelous masked men and women. So at least those two episodes will be coming up as well. And then who knows what else? We've got a lot of irons in the fire, so to speak, here at Monster Kid Radio. I'm excited about what the future holds. I'm excited for future segments, and I'm excited to share them all with you. So please come back next week for more Monster Kid Radio goodness.
Monster Kid Radio is a Team Death production. All original content of Monster Kid Radio is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 Unported license. You can learn more about Team Death, our other projects like Death Designs, Mail Order Zombie, Monster Kid Writer, and more at www.teamdeath.com. Remember, death is spelled D-E-T-H. That's teamdeath.com. Please rate and review Monster Kid Radio wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Curse the Living is copyright 2023 Shango. It's from their album Reverb of the Living Dead. You can find them over at shangosurf.bandcamp.com. Pick up their entire album. Just let them know that you heard about them here on Monster Kid Radio when you do. My name is Derek M. Cook. I'll talk to everybody next week. Ciao.